Greetings. This is Nick here, one of the pastors here at St. Catherine's United Mennonite Church. I realize with my recording last time I failed to introduce myself, but if you're listening, you're likely well aware that our services, along with many other churches, have been canceled for the next couple of weeks, at least. A situation with coronavirus, COVID-19, continues to develop. If you're looking for updates, you'll find the latest on our website. My plan for this Sunday is to record again the next message I had prepared for our series, looking at the Book of Daniel. But I'll also be doing something a little different as well, and recording an additional short reflection on the times we find ourselves in today, and that'll be focusing in on the lectionary texts for this week. So if you're interested, you can find that by clicking the audio services link on our websites. Otherwise, we'll start by looking at the text that we had picked out for this Sunday. It comes again, as I mentioned, from the Book of Daniel, and the series we're looking at is called Integrity, looking at what this book and the life and story of Daniel might have to show us as people living in our world today. And our text, as I've chosen it, comes from Daniel chapter 5, verses 1 to 12, and I'll just read it for you now. I invite you to read along, as I did last week, and if you have a Bible nearby, you could read through the whole chapter and get the whole story as well. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink with them from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lamp stand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. Then he said to those wise men from Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "May the king live forever," she said. "Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means." Are there times when people of conscience and faith might speak truth to power? This morning, as I mentioned, I'm continuing a series prepared looking at the Book of Daniel, the series called Integrity, exploring what this ancient story of faithfulness in a time of exile might show us about what it means to live with integrity in the time and place we find ourselves in today. And as you've heard, we're picking things up in chapter 5 today. Last week we looked at chapter 3, the story of the fiery furnace. Chapter 4, which falls In between that and this week's text is about another one of Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. This time the Babylonian king has this dream about this massive tree. It's mixed in with all this other cryptic language and imagery. And Nebuchadnezzar, we read, is deeply disturbed to have dreamt and woken up from such a thing. And so as with before, he asks all of his wise men, his sages, magicians, enchanters, and astrologers to come and make sense of it for him. And as with before, none of them, it turns out, are able to. They're all stumped, as perplexed as he is. And so again, the king Nebuchadnezzar summons Daniel, this exiled Jew, to interpret it, to make sense of it. Daniel, we read, upon discerning the meaning of this strange vision, ends up becoming troubled himself. I wish I did not have to tell you what it meant, he says. I wish that its meaning applied to the worst of your enemies, but I have to tell you it's about you. Daniel goes on to tell him that he, Nebuchadnezzar, is the tree from the dream that's about to be cut down. He'll fall, it turns out, from grace. He'll be toppled and tumble from his lofty position of power. He'll be driven away from society in a brutal and bizarre way, made by some unseen force to crawl about the dirt like a wild animal and eat the grass like a feral creature. And thus it is that it comes to pass, the sudden downfall and collapse of this once mighty one. One moment, Nebuchadnezzar's strutting about the rooftop of his palace, taking in and taking credit for the empire that he saw stretch out before him, admiring this great city of Babylon. And the very next, it's all over. He hears this voice, which comes to him out of nowhere. You are no longer ruler, it says. Your place in power is no more. And sure enough, dethroned and disgraced king, made to leave that place as his dream and as Daniel said it would be. Of course, it's not all over. In the vision, the stump of that tree remains. We're told that his strange and suffering-filled circumstances will only last a symbolic 7 times. And then the king will return and the kingdom will be restored. And indeed, as we read and as we'll see, that's how it will be. There's a saying you might have heard, or maybe some variation of it. It goes like this. Speak the truth even when your voice shakes. I imagine Daniel's voice must have shaken that day. His knees must have been all tremors as he stood before the king and said his peace. It's a hard and heavy truth that he was tasked with relaying, having sorted out and made sense of Nebuchadnezzar's dream for him. I'm begging you, Daniel tells him, listen and stop. Stop what you're doing to the people and do what's right. Do what's just, he says. Be merciful to the poor. Be kind to the oppressed. And then it may be, O king, that your prosperity will continue. Maybe then this coming madness will come to an end. Makes me wonder where Daniel found his boldness to say all that day. It makes me wonder, again, if there are times today when people of conscience and faith might speak truth to power. Speak truth to power. You'll likely have heard that phrase. It originated apparently in a little booklet that was produced by a group of Quakers in the 1950s. A Search for an Alternative to Violence was the publication's subtitle. It referred to this alternative form of resistance and action in the face of international crises and morally corrupt political leaders and systems. Here's how one website that I found defined speaking truth to power. Speak truth to power, it says, means to confront those who hold important positions, whether in government, business, or religious institutions. To speak truth to power means to demand a moral response to a problem rather than an expedient, easy, or selfish response. If you go online, there's a tool that you can use called the Ngram Viewer. If you Google it, you can find it. It's a Google tool. It's this internet search engine that can display the usage over time of any particular word or phrase that you put into it. I was curious as I was thinking about this, and so I went there and typed in the phrase, speak truth to power. If you wanted to, you could hit pause on this and do the same. You could look it up right now. I did and looked, and sure enough, this phrase, speak truth to power, pops up around 1950, as with the origin story of it, with the publication there. And then you see it spike in this graph in the late 1960s and into the 70s, which I think when you think about it makes good sense, given everything in the air at the time. The Vietnam War and the women's and civil rights movements especially. And then it takes a bit of a dip, but then a sharp and steady incline through to the most recent years of available data. Clearly, as a phrase, it's taken off. But it also makes you wonder, what is it about what's happened in these past three decades, the 90s, the aughts, and the 2010s, that has it being used more and more? Can only guess, but I imagine we wouldn't have too much difficulty doing so. We can think of the political tensions and upheavals, the stock market crashes and the Occupy movements, all the instances of corporate crookedness and of endless military operations in the Middle East, situations in which people around the world saw a corruption of power and felt the need to speak up in some way, to speak truth to power in response. And we stop and wonder amidst all of those things, things like that, how we as Christians ought to respond. And we wonder again, are there times when people of faith and conscience might step forward and speak truth to power? We're told that these events of Daniel chapter 5 that I read today, and maybe you read along with, take place some years later after those described in that previous chapter. A series of kings, we're told, had since taken and left the throne, and a man named Belshazzar is currently in power. And we're told that this Belshazzar throws a massive banquet one day, a big meal for all of his appointees and friends. And as the wine begins to flow, the Babylonian king tells his servants to bring out the Israelite silverware. If you remember back to the first chapter, in the first week of the series, you'll recall that King Nebuchadnezzar had stolen all of this silver and gold items from the temple when he had taken hold of Jerusalem. And so those goblets are got and then filled to the brim and filled to the brim again and again. And all the while, Belshazzar and his table mates shout out praise to their idols. Gods were told of gold and silver, iron, wood, and stone. You really need to imagine this, right? Picture this scene and stop maybe for a minute and think about how the earliest Jewish recipients and readers of this story would have reacted hearing about what had been done here. They would have been livid. It was an utterly offensive act of desecration for them, this insult. It was blasphemy. It was this really infuriating scene because these objects set aside for a holy purpose, for a holy God, were being used for the careless consumption of a pagan oppressor. I can imagine it might have been as upsetting as the king using a section of Torah as a dinner napkin or tearing off a piece to blow his nose. We read that the revelry and hard partying continue here, temple china in hand, so to speak, until suddenly the entire banquet hall falls silent. And everybody sees it. It's there near the lampstand by the wall. It's this human hand that appears out of nowhere, attached to nobody. And no one has any clue what's going on, not least of all the king himself, who is so distraught by these disembodied digits that we're told in verse 6 that his legs become weak and his knees were knocking. His legs were shaking. We read that the floating hand then begins to write on the wall. the king is going to faint. He's going to be sick. He catches his breath and calls his enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. Will someone please tell me what's going on here? I'll give you whatever you want, anything. I'll make you third in command. Just tell me what this means. But as with before, his helpers prove helpless. They're useless. They had nothing. They could give him no explanation. And so, again, as with before, he calls for Daniel. King Belshazzar is frantic now, in a state of panicked desperation. He offers Daniel the same heap of rewards that he was offering the others. Here, have it all. I don't care. Just help me. Daniel, we read, declines it. I'll interpret your dream, sure, but you can keep that. Refusing the gifts, but offering a service, he maintains his distance. He maintains his integrity as he begins to lay into the king. Daniel recalls for Belshazzar the events that we read about earlier, the time when the hard-hearted Nebuchadnezzar was rebuked and sent out wild into the wilds. Nebuchadnezzar came around and humbled himself, Daniel tells Belshazzar. He was power-hungry, power-crazed, and power-abusing, but through this humiliating experience he went through, he came to recognize the true power, the power above all powers, God's. But you, Belshazzar, have not. Daniel points to the cup full of booze resting in the king's now clammy hands. You're taking sips from God's glass as if it were a red plastic party cup. And you've gone on about all these other gods, gods of material things, not seeing and not honoring the true immaterial God who made them all. And so Daniel continues, I'll tell you what this hand is all about. I'll explain what the handwriting means. But I have to warn you, Your Highness, you're not going to like it. They look over together and they see it. Four words scrawled out in Aramaic. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Here's what they mean, Daniel tells them. God has numbered your days as king. Your rule will soon be over. You've been weighed on the scales and found wanting, Daniel says to him, and your kingdom will be divided and given to others. Your mighty empire will be split up piece by piece. Speak the truth even when your voice shakes, even when your legs shake, even when your knees shake. In this story, I believe we see this incredible boldness on the parts of Daniel. It was this well-known fact then and now that ancient kings like these made a practice of shooting the messenger. We read that Nebuchadnezzar, after all, put to death those he wished to put to death. The fact that Daniel, for some strange reason, thought was a good idea to share again with his present company. Kings like these had no qualms whatsoever with killing the bearers of bad news. It wouldn't have bothered Belshazzar's conscience one bit to have done so. And yet we see Daniel, despite that, willingly come when summoned. He stood before the king who, if he wasn't already unpredictable, would likely have been on account of all his imbibing that night. And we see Daniel say what he saw and what he saw that it meant. That definition that I found and mentioned earlier, the definition of that phrase, speaking truth to power, it continues like this. The phrase truth to power, the phrase speak truth to power carries a connotation of bravery, of risking either the status quo, one's reputation or livelihood, or the wrath of the person one is confronting. Daniel spoke truth to power. He spoke the truth that Belshazzar's power, the power of empires and emperors, was fleeting and illusory. The truth that it would all in an instant come crumbling down before him. Again, we might think what that must have taken for Daniel. Think of the resolve and the audacity, the strength and the courage to get up there and say all this. Can you imagine it? Belshazzar, we're told, does good on the promise that he made for whoever could provide this interpretation for him. He goes and fetches the fine clothes and the gold jewelry for Daniel and signs off on his promised promotion. But it makes no difference to the fate that's been set for him. Just as Daniel had told him standing there in the banquet hall, it was all over. Belshazzar was slain that very night, and his throne was usurped by a neighboring king. Are there times when people of conscience and faith might speak truth to power, to kings, to people at the top, people in charge, to leaders and to politicians? Daniel provides this fascinating example because even as he rises the ranks of the Babylonian system, he refuses all along the way to be entirely cozy with the politician of his day. He complies and cooperates, but he will not allow himself to be co-opted. He will not allow his convictions to be compromised. Daniel is integrated and engaged in this all, and yet he maintains a prophetic distance. I think we see this again and again throughout this book, and then again here in this chapter. He declines the king's offer of reimbursement here from the very start. He maintains his integrity and refuses what very well might be seen as a bribe. You can keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to somebody else, he says. He remains devoted and differentiated, which is important, I think, because we know that when it comes to society and politics, if you become overly aligned, if you become fully entrenched, you lose the ability to maintain a critical stance, which I think is part of the reason why this sort of thing, this idea of speaking truth to power, can make a lot of people uncomfortable. Because so often when people of faith attempt to do this sort of thing or think they're doing this sort of thing, it falls into familiar partisan political patterns. The church ends up becoming just one of many groups lobbying the government and pressuring society. We see this kind of side-taking, agenda-hitching, unholy alliances formed between faith groups and political groups, between faith leaders and political leaders. And we can see why it's so tempting, I think, to go to that place, especially in a time like Daniel's, where the community of faith shifts to this minority presence within culture. We can see why people might view that as an appropriate and effective and necessary way to bring about change in the world, to campaign and vote and rally, to write letters to your elected officials. And I believe those might very well be responsible and right ways of acting in the world at times. And many times even. And yet I believe that when that prophetic distance is lost, when it's no longer one foot in and one foot out like it was for Daniel and his companions, you all too often see this loss of integrity and a loss of ability to truly speak truth to power as he does here. Are there times when people of conscience and faith might speak truth to power? I grew up as a shy, quiet, and anxious kid. If any of you listening know me, you likely have gotten that sense from the years. You've gotten to know me. I'm not exactly an in-your-face or disturb-the-peace kind of person. Like I'm sure it is for a lot of people who are wired the same way. I used to take me a lot of time to go toe-to-toe to someone when I felt I had to. This might sound foreign to some of you, but I know some of you will immediately understand what I mean when I say that. It often involved this kind of rehearsing and summoning of energy and will to get to that place, to be able to take a critical stance, to speak truth to someone in a position of power or authority, to confront or to stand up to a powerful personality. And it's not something that has happened often, but I can picture myself in those moments walking nervously to that door or picking up the phone or just knocking and answering, tracking with all the small talk until I finally managed to bring myself to say what I'd come to say. Some of you listening are probably thinking, What's wrong with this kid? Just say it. Blurt it out. Get it out. What's the problem? If you're wired that way, great. That sort of thing comes easy. Maybe sometimes too easy, such that sometimes it gets you in trouble. Such that your ease with saying what you feel are hard words can cause deep hurts. I imagine some of you know exactly what I mean when I talk about, when I think about those times in my life. And so for people like me, for people like that. So I believe that Daniel provides a really powerful example, an example of boldness and integrity, of spiritual conviction and courage, of depth of spirit and willingness to speak up and speak out when my conscience requires it. Daniel provides me an example of speaking the truth even when my voice shakes, even when my legs shake. Many years after this story was recorded, the Apostle Paul would go on to tell the Christians in Ephesus to speak the truth in love. Speak the truth in love. It's maybe hard to see that here in this story. Daniel speaks this painful prophetic truth plainly, and it's a sad and severe ending for the king of Babylon. And yet from this story, from this book, Daniel didn't seem to seek any personal gain or satisfaction from saying them. They seem to come out of a humble submission to his God more than out of any kind of personal opinion or spite or frustration or anger. Instead, his words, I believe, came out of a place of deep devotion, of a place of desire to be obedient to God in the midst of the opportunities and situations that he's presented with. I'd invite you to look at that little graph, if it's still up on the screen in front of you, the one I talked about earlier that displays how often that phrase truth to power has been used over the past century or so. I would invite you to think about what kinds of contexts people might be writing and saying that phrase today, as apparently it's used more and more frequently around the world. What sorts of situations come to your mind? What headlines, what images, where are there people today feeling the need to speak truth to power? Where are people pointing to corrupted power, abusive power? I wonder what comes to mind, to your mind. For me, I think of the Me Too movement. I think of climate activists confronting politicians on inaction. I picture rallies in support of refugee rights. I think of groups and leaders gathering in the streets and in front of legislative assemblies calling for an end to capital punishment, for nuclear weapons to be abolished. I think of groups and leaders signing statements calling on political leaders to pull back from the brink of world war, as we saw at the start of this year. And I think, of course, about what everyone's thinking about these days, what everyone can't help but think about all the time. Coronavirus, COVID-19, and the calls being made on people in power to act, and act quickly. So we come back to that question again, and wondering, how might the church respond? How might we as the church respond in the midst of all that? Does the church lead the way, follow suit, stand back and watch, or take another approach altogether? Are there times when people of faith might take that sort of stance and speak truth to power? It's hard to know what effect it might have as a form of action, but are there times when Christian conscience simply will not allow us to keep silence? Times when we, like Daniel, are invited to speak the truth even when our voice shakes. Amen.